Members, we're going to start the hearing today because our Judge Pust has to be out of here on time today, so welcome her to the table and she can start. And before you start, I'd like to recognize we have, and now we have a quorum, so I'm going to call this meeting officially to order. We have our permanent page that has been assigned to us, Nyuma. If you want to come up to a microphone and introduce yourself, and then we'll get on with the hearing.
All right, good morning, everyone. My name is Nyuma. I'll be your permanent page, and nice meeting you all.
Welcome to the committee. And then Judge Pust, if you want to proceed and identify yourself for the tape. And
thank you. Good morning, everyone. I hope that you all stay warm and get home safely. My name is Tammy Pust, and I'm the Chief Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings, and thank you so much for allowing me to be here today. I have a presentation for you just giving you a little bit of information about what the Office of Administrative Hearings does and how we pay for it. So, first of all, we're an agency in the executive branch of government. We were created in 1975. We right now have 26 judges and 40 administrative staff. One of us, that'd be me, is appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate to a six-year term, made 6 years so as to reduce the political affiliation of the office and instead make sure that our judges serve as fair and impartial fact finders for all sides in all matters. So I'm the only one, though, that is appointed and confirmed. All the other
Judge,
judges.
Can you pull the microphone closer? And I know you can turn the volume up on it so that, yeah.
Do I turn the volume up? It says room volume. Do I do it here?
No? Yes.
All right. How's that?
Oh, great.
Way better. All right. Tammy Pust again. So I'm appointed. None of the rest of the judges are appointed. They're all civil servants, and so are the rest of the staff. We have two offices in the state, one right across the street over here at what we think of as the revenue building. We have our courtrooms on the first floor and our administrative offices on the second floor. And we also, by statute, have an office in Duluth. Now, I mentioned that we were a court, and I also mentioned that we were in the executive branch. That should bring some of you back to sort of eighth grade civics and think about, wait a minute, we have three branches of government, and generally the courts are the courts. There are three courts in the state of Minnesota that are not part of the judicial branch, but instead are part of the executive branch. And all that means is these courts weren't created by the Constitution. They were created by the legislature and placed in the executive branch. We're one, the Office of Administrative Hearings. The tax court is another, and the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals is the third. What do we do? Generally speaking, we hear all contested cases, which is really just another word for trials, on challenges to government actions. We call that in the statute contested cases. We also do all the workers' comp trials in the state. So let me kind of bring you through some of that. When we hear a case at OAH in workers' comp and somebody doesn't like what our judges have found, then there's a right to an appeal. And that appeal goes to the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals. And after that, if people don't like the decision of the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals, that decision goes to the Minnesota Supreme Court for review. All the other cases that we do, the contested cases that aren't workers' comp, we make a decision. Appeals go to the regular Minnesota Court of Appeals and on from there to the Minnesota Supreme Court. These are the types of cases that we have. Generally, we spend about two-thirds of our time, if you're counting up sort of people and what they do during the day, on workers' comp, and about a third on everything else. Right now, the office has 18 workers' comp judges and 22 administrative staff dedicated to that work. We have two people dedicated to the work of municipal boundary adjustments. That's a separate little segment of contested cases where if somebody in a city or township owns property that right now is in the township and they want to be in the city, why would they want to be in the city? Maybe because they want city services. Or maybe they're in the city and they want to be in the township. Why would they want that? Maybe because the tax rates are different. Lots of other reasons for those kinds of things. But if you want to adjust where the municipal boundaries are, those cases come through us. We have two people that work on that. All the actual hearings that come out of that work, I do. And then there's everything else. And we call that our administrative law division. We have 8 judges and 9 dedicated staff, and then we have 7 people who do things like payroll and contracts and sort of the administrative staff that serve the entire agency. So now, workers' comp specifically. We have up to 12,000 filings every year in workers' comp. Of those, we settle the vast majority. The parties settle the vast majority, and about 800 go to hearing in front of a workers' comp judge. But we issue about 2,000 orders because a lot of times there will be motions beforehand or we issue orders as a result of settlements. This work is not general fund supported. It's supported by an appropriation from the special compensation fund, and currently that's about $7.8 million. All the laws that regulate the work of workers' comp, both at the Office of Administrative Hearings and at the Department of Labor and Industry, are found in Chapter 176. Here's some other tidbit facts that sometimes people find interesting about workers' comp. The system, the judicial system, our system, we don't appoint lawyers for workers' comp. The statute allows people to have lawyers, and lawyers are paid statutorily particular rates that the legislature has set out of the proceeds of whatever the decision is or the settlement that's reached. We provide a lot of what we call ADR, alternative dispute resolution, specifically mediation. We've trained our judges to be rostered mediators, rostered by the Minnesota Supreme Court, which means they have to take a certain amount of training and keep it up on a 3-year cycle. And so we do hundreds of mediations in the workers' comp world a year, and we have a really high success rate. I'll get to that in a second. The biggest news in workers' comp, excuse me, is that in 2018, we were the last court in the state of Minnesota to implement e-filing, and that was on the workers' comp side. And so if any of you have ever worked anywhere where you got a new computer system, you can all commiserate with me that, in fact, the first day when you flip the switch, it's not perfect, and it takes some time to work the kinks out. That's been true for us as well. But the practitioners that use that system, both on the defense side, representing employers in the state, or representing injured workers, all document that it is quicker, cheaper, saves them postage, and saves them printing, and that therefore drives costs down in the workers' comp system, which is a good thing. That's workers' comp. Then I said there's the other everything else. Well, the everything else, again, can be chunked into 2 things. One, rulemaking, and the other, contested case hearings, or what we think of as trials. Rules and statutes that you pass have the same force and effect of law. Every court in the state of Minnesota is going to hold people accountable to following what the statutes are that you pass and what the rules are that are promulgated by state agencies. I have lots of other presentations about rulemaking, which I won't get into because I know that's not your purview, but it's an important function that you, the legislature, have delegated that authority to state agencies, and you maintain lots of checks and balances on that system. I'm happy to answer questions about that at any other time. So how's that division funded? Well, first of all, in the main, over 93% of that division is funded by an enterprise fund, which means, I used to say we eat what we kill, now I'm trying to say we spend what we earn, which is we bill our time, just like any law firm bills its time. So we have a rate plan that gets approved by the Minnesota Management and Budget every year that says, anticipating what of our costs are going to be, 86% of which is staff, and then there's rent and things like that. Anticipating our costs and knowing how many cases we're going to have, how does that math work out so that we can come up with an hourly billable rate? Currently, our hourly billable rate is $170 an hour. Our judges and our staff attorneys then record their time down to the tenth of an hour every day of time spent on any particular matter, and by statute, those costs are pushed back to the state agencies whose case we are involved in. So if it's somebody challenging action of the Department of Human Services, that case goes through our system, and the Department of Human Services gets a bill and pays for those bills. So that's what's called an enterprise fund. It's not general funding. It's funds that come through the rest of the agency on an invoice basis, and it's invoiced monthly. Right now, that's about 3.31 $3,300,000 in that enterprise fund. Another thing that you need to know, because you care about money, we need to break even in that fund. There's no reason to be, there's not a slush fund, there's not a, we don't build up sort of excess so that we could have it later. That's not allowed. MMB only really allows us to have an extra 2 months to make sure for cash flow purposes, in case people are late paying their bills, state agencies late paying their bills, we can still make our payroll. We do have tiny bits of general fund, and they're in these cases. I mentioned boundary adjustments before. We have an appropriation of $263,000 that supports those two people, and that's because the statute doesn't allow us to bill back the costs of that to the cities and townships unless there's a hearing. If there's a hearing, the costs of the hearing get billed back to the cities and townships that are involved in whatever that dispute is. We also have authority under Minnesota Statute 13.085 to do expedited data practices cases. This is another small little subset of cases. If the public doesn't think their government agencies are giving them the data that they're entitled to, their own data, they have a right to challenge the government, saying the government's response, saying we don't have to, it's not yours, whatever. They have a right to bring a case to us. We get $22,000 to support those cases. And then we also hear campaign practice cases, which are generally cases about whether or not your lawn signs have the appropriate disclaimers or whether or not your endorsements from meet the statutory requirements. And we get $115,000 in general fund money to support that work. And why is that? It's because there isn't a public entity at stake that we could bill back through the enterprise fund. So when the legislature gave us that work, it also had to provide a funding source for it. We also have a tiny amount of money, $50,000 a year, that gets transferred to us from the MPCA to do sanitary district work. Remember I talked a little bit about municipal boundary adjustments involving cities and townships? Well, we also can do sanitary districts. We have our very first case, and as a result of that, the MPCA transferred to us money to support that work. Here's the numbers on those enterprise fund kind of cases. There's about 750 of these kinds of cases that are filed every year. We do about 150 hearings, which tells you that, again, the vast majority of cases settle either through mediation that we offer or through just the efforts of the parties, as in most courts. We also last year did 112 rule reviews for 30 different state agencies. Again, it's $3.3 million in the enterprise fund paid by the state agencies. And all of that work is regulated by the provisions that you've passed in Chapter 14. Here's a listing of the broad scope of cases that those might be. They might be, and they are, the work that we do for the Public Utilities Commission. All those public hearings having to do with Line 3 or Enbridge or anything else, those are the judges of the Office of Administrative Hearings out and across the state, conducting those public hearings for the PUC. Might also be DHS licensure revocation. In fact, with my apologies, I have to leave today right after my presentation because the Department of Human Services has temporarily suspended somebody's child care license in Dakota County. They have a right to a hearing. I go to Dakota County, and our hearing starts at 10 o'clock. So I'll be leaving at 8:45. That's my subtle way of telling you I'll be happy to hear questions. Okay, so there's all sorts of licenses, right? We license nurses, and we license doctors, and we license chiropractors, and we license a lot of people, and a lot of those different professions have a right, if their license is touched by the state, either suspended or revoked, or for whatever reasons, they have a right to a hearing. Those are heard at OAH. The one thing that we do that has to do with criminal law is, we call them ECRCs. They are when a sex offender has served their time and is about to get out. They get, by law, a community notification rating, which says who in the community is going to know where that sex offender lives. Is it just law enforcement? Is it all the school districts and other public entities in the area? Or is it the whole neighborhood? That depends on if the Department of Corrections gives the offender a 1, 2, or 3 rating. If they get anything other than the lowest rating, they have a right to a hearing before us. We do those by video conference. We do hearings on inspections of nursing homes. If, in fact, the nursing home anywhere in the state is found to have violated some of the either state or federal requirements of how they should be caring for the elderly, They get a citation. That's a very public thing. They have a right to challenge that. Those are heard at OEH. Also, if nursing homes want to ask somebody to leave for non-payment or for other reasons of being disruptive or a list of other things that people can't do in nursing homes, you can't just kick somebody out of a nursing home. They, too, have a right to a hearing, and those are done by the judges at OEH at the affected nursing homes anywhere in the state. Anything having to do with licenses, permits, veterans' preference, the list goes on and on. It's a really broad scope of cases. It's a really interesting mix of work on every ALJ's desk, and we thank you for it every day because you're the ones who actually said we are the ones that should do them. And actually, if I was in the judicial branch, which I'm not, they would thank you as well, because all of those thousands of cases that we do not go to the trial courts in the judicial branch. And so while we are not a part of them, we are partners with them, and they, too, are very appreciative of our work. Again, on boundary adjustments, this is we've already talked about it. We have statewide jurisdiction, so we go anywhere and everywhere. And again, these are the kinds of cases where somebody either wants to become part of something, leave part of something, or when cities want to consolidate or dissolve. The other general fund cases, we talked about it a little bit already, data practices and fair campaign practices. In all of these kinds of cases, all of our contested cases, here's some interesting facts about that. Nobody has a right to an attorney at OEH paid for at public expense. Everybody has a right to an attorney, but everyone also has a right to represent themselves, and we do not have the authority to appoint attorneys for anybody in any kind of case. The Attorney General's office represents the state agencies in the cases that come before us. We hear evidence, we make decisions, we write up our decisions in what's called findings of fact, conclusions of law, and a recommended order. And this is important. It's really only in about 10% of the cases that we make the final order. In 90% of the cases, by law, our decision, the judge's decision, is a recommended order that is sent to the commissioner of that agency who can either yay or nay it. If they don't want to agree with the decision that the ALJ has made, they have to put in writing why it is they're not agreeing with it and what it is we got wrong. So they can't simply willy-nilly flip it. They have to make a public record as to what the judge didn't get right. So I can tell you that the vast, huge, you know, over 90% are, in fact, affirmed by the commissioners. But by law, we don't make the final decision. The commissioners do. And in any other way, it mirrors every other court process that you have ever heard about or watched on TV. Rulemaking, not going to go into this except to point out to you, there's lots of different kinds of rulemaking, statutory processes that the legislature has passed over the years. And in all of those processes, in different ways, but in all of those processes, the rules that get through the process have to be reviewed at OEH and either approved or not. And if they're not approved, they're not a rule, they die. The agency has to start over. By statute, and again, this is in Chapter 14, an administrative law judge has to disapprove a rule if the agency has skipped any of the statutory processes that you've put in place. If they have started a rule process and through the process changed the proposed rule so much that it doesn't match what they told the public they were going to do, then they have to start over because it fails for having told the public exactly what we're doing. If they exceed their delegated authority, which means if you, the legislature, as you have to in most cases, you have to tell them you may pass rules on this topic. If they instead add some other topic that you didn't tell them they could, then they've exceeded their authority and we have to say, I'm sorry, you have to start over. There's also statutory provisions that we have to disapprove their rule if they have improperly influence the public not to seek a hearing, or if they've otherwise improperly delegated their powers. For example, if an agency says, well, the legislature told us to do it, but we're going to simply ask this other trade association to simply do the whole rulemaking and we will just put our name on it, we'll have nothing to do with it, that would violate your statutes and we wouldn't allow that through either. So that's some ways it could get disapproved. The other ways that things can get disapproved is if we find the rule is, and this is the statutory language, not necessary or reasonable. what's important about that is it's not our authority. We do not have jurisdiction to decide whether a proposed rule is the best idea. It's our decision on whether or not it's necessary. Well, it's necessary if you've delegated the authority to them and if it's reasonable. It's only reasonable, and we find these things to be not reasonable all the time, if the evidence that's in the record, which includes every public comment and the agency's written response to every public comment, which is required, if all of that evidence does not show that this particular proposal is reasonable, then we'll find it not to be and we'll make suggestions about how they could change it. We also disapprove rules if they're unconstitutional or illegal. What does that mean? It generally means they're too vague and people don't know what you're talking about. Because under the Constitution, we have to give people due process, which means notice of what's required or prohibited. And if your language is too vague and people don't know, then that wouldn't meet the constitutional test. Or if something is not a rule at all, and that happens very infrequently, but there sometimes agencies will be doing things that really aren't rules because they don't affect people's substantive legal rights. And if they don't affect people's substantive legal rights under the statute that you have promulgated, it's not a rule. Might be a policy, might be a bulletin, it's not a rule. Now, every time I say that, I do get questions, and so just let me answer that. Is there a process for people to challenge, hey, I think this thing's a rule that they're saying is just a policy or a guidance? Yes, there is. It's in Chapter 14, and I should have the site in the top of my head, but I don't. I'm happy to send it to the committee if you'd like it. But the public can come to the Office of Administrative Hearings, start a case, it's a $50 filing fee, to say this state agency can't do this thing because what they're doing is enforcing an unadopted rule, and that's not okay. They got to go through the rulemaking process. So, again, the legislature historically, in its wisdom, has foreseen that perhaps somebody would get out of the box at some point in time, and there would need to be a process for the public to bring the government back into line. And so that exists, and it's used from time to time. With that, are there questions? I'm happy to answer them.
Great. And members, as she said earlier, she has to be out of here by 8:45, so we can make short questions and get through this so she can leave and be in Dakota County where she has to be. Start with Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Judge, just real quick, a clarification. So you have jurisdiction over nursing homes, not assisted livings or senior housing?
Judge Pust.
Mr. Chair and members, we currently have jurisdiction over nursing homes and other licensed facilities by the Department of Health. I know there's legislation going through this session that has to do with assisted living. It does have the language about appeals from that would come to the Office of Administrative Hearings just like nursing homes would.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Pust, good morning.
Good morning.
Chapter 14, .126 talks about the rulemaking authority or rule adoption that the legislature grants. And you ruled on a case, I think, last spring with regard to a committee in ag where they overstepped their bounds, or we wanted to make sure they didn't overstep their bounds. And the administration actually said they disregarded that ruling. Could you speak just a little bit to how that case unfolded before your court?
I can, and I'm sorry I don't have it here with me, so I can't really cite you to it, although I'm sure that the decisions are up on our website, and so if anyone needs them, I can get them to them. It's had to do with the Department of Agricultural rule, and I'm sorry, I think it had something to do with nitrates, but I don't really know. There is a provision in 14.126 that says that if the legislature, the committees with primary jurisdiction over a particular subject matter of a particular rule, if both bodies, both the House and the Senate, those committees adopt a resolution telling the state agencies, hold on, don't adopt that rule, we want to look at it. The statute says when that happens, the final rule cannot be adopted until after the next session that comes up, the end of that next session. So in this particular case, the Department of Agriculture, I really don't know when they started that rule, but when it came to us during the process, it came to us during last session. During last session, the policy committees in both the House and the Senate, and I apologize because I never practice ag law, so I'm not sure what the ag committees are, but they're the substantive ag committees in both the House and the Senate passed resolutions saying, directing the Department of Agriculture not to adopt the rule until after the next session, and which would be this session. That rule proceeded at OAH because the Chapter 14 simply says the Office of Administrative Hearing goes through this process of reviewing the rules to make sure all the statutory processes are met, and we did. I don't believe it was actually until later in the summer, as everything was finalized and they presented us the proposed rule, and then it's our time to say yay or nay. Did you meet all those procedural steps? Did you have the delegated authority? Everything that was just on that slide. And in that, we then issued a ruling. I issued a ruling that all these things are true. You've met all those things. But 14.126 says you can't adopt it until the end of the next session because these two resolutions were adopted. Here are the two resolutions. Therefore, the statute applies. Therefore, you can't adopt it until the end of the 2019 session.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Post, you'd said that I think it was last year that 112 new rules were adopted in Minnesota. Can you tell me how many were denied?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm sorry I can't tell you that off the top of my head, but I can follow up with you. What I meant to say was 112 proceedings were presented to us. That doesn't mean they were all approved. So there's some approved and some not, and I can certainly get you the breakdown of those 112.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just quickly, you had said you have a lot of other information on rulemaking. Is there a place I can get that?
Judge.
You could come to law school for legislators, but it was last Friday, so you missed that. I'm happy to send you my PowerPoint. I'm not sure if that would be helpful. I'm happy to come over and walk you through it. I did the presentation in the Senate side last week as well on rulemaking, so I do have a presentation on rulemaking.
Well, I would really appreciate the PowerPoint. I don't know if you want to waste your valuable time on me, but maybe one day if you have some extra time, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure.
Judge. Representative Green. Representative Eilers. Oh, Elkins. I'm looking at the name. I was questioning two of these.
Didn't recognize that name.
Yeah, I didn't recognize it either. but I read it as it was written.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge, I have a case that has been brought to my attention about one of my municipalities, a campaign finance violation, a completely anonymous literature was sent out. So the people who would be complainants about it have been referred to your office where they were told that, well, we do hearings, but we don't do investigations. So in order to determine the source of the mailing, there would have to be an investigation by somebody with a subpoena power. So in your opinion, which body do you think that would be? I would have guessed that it would be a county attorney's responsibility, but they don't seem to want to accept it.
Judge.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't mean to fit into any stereotype of a judge who won't comment on cases that they don't know the facts of, but I can't comment on cases that I don't know the facts of. I mean, I'm happy to look at that issue for you as to who does investigations.
Of violations of campaign finance.
You know, what happens is the parties themselves have done the investigations on most of the cases that come forward. Now, maybe in this particular case they've tried and it doesn't work. I don't know that the county attorney would have the authority to do that because they don't enforce that statute, so I don't know where the subpoena power would come from. Now, obviously, the Office of Administrative Hearings has the power to subpoena records, and so any party to a filing can request a subpoena for us. In a case where they don't know who to serve the subpoena on, I'm not sure that's very helpful.
Yeah. Representative Elkins.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned that you have an enterprise fund. And I'm curious how you manage that closely, because there must be years where you have unexpected activities during the year that it would have been hard to anticipate. So, you know, I appreciate you trying to manage it, but I'm just curious, if things come up that weren't anticipated and there isn't enough in the two-month reserve or whatever, is there loans from the general fund, or how would that be made up?
Judge.
Mr. Chair and members, I've served in this position for 5.5 years, and that hasn't come up in the 5.5 years, and truly I can't anticipate in what circumstances it would, because most of our cost is driven by staff. You're not going to all of a sudden have a 10-person addition to staff that you didn't anticipate, so you're not going to bring in more. Really, the issue is going to be on the other side. You might have 10 retirements that you didn't anticipate, so you'd have a lot of salary savings that would fall to a bottom line. And truly, when I came into the position, for inadvertent reasons, the rates had been set too high by my predecessor. And so over the first 2 years, what we did was artificially deflate, with the permission of MMB, the hourly rate, so that people weren't charged the value of it as if there wasn't money, because there was money that had fallen to the bottom line. Because we can't have that. And so we need to actually use that instead of continue to charge state agencies for costs that they already paid. So I do manage that really carefully, and I hope I'm not back here next year saying, well, now something happened that I didn't anticipate. But truly, it's a process that we project what our expenses are based on what they have been historically, and then we monitor that on a monthly basis to see where are we at based on what we thought we were going to be spending and what we are spending and what cases have come in. Now, if all of a sudden the other agencies stopped any enforcement work, stopped any regulatory work, therefore people didn't have appeals, therefore they didn't bring cases, that would be a problem. So far that hasn't happened.
So, Judge, if there's money left over that you say falls to the bottom line, what happens to that money? Does it go back in the general fund, or where does it go?
It had never happened before until I came. There was money that was on the bottom line. It does. There is no place that it goes back to the general fund because it didn't come from the general fund. So, again, what we did was, instead of charging $100 for our services for a year and a half, we charged $65 so that agencies were getting the benefit of what they had already paid, and therefore we used the money that had already been collected before we ever then reassessed what the actual hourly rate should be.
Representative Lowe. Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thanks, members, for getting this done quickly. And Representative or Judge Pust, thank you for being at the meeting, and
thanks for having me.
And happily be on your way.
Thanks.
Members, while we're here and waiting for the next person to come forward, Representative Elkins, have you read the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair. I would be pleased to move the approval of the minutes from the meeting of January 24th.
Representative Elkins moves approval of the minutes of January 24th, 2019. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes have been approved. Then our next up on our agenda is Ampers. And welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Good morning. For the record, my name is Joel Glazer. I am the CEO of AMPERS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. Before I begin, I would like to thank the committee for having us here this morning. Thank you for braving the bitter cold, but also, perhaps most importantly, thank you for your continued support of our organization. I've been asked to brief you today, and it will be fairly brief, on what AMPERS is. And there's good reason for that, because when I worked in commercial radio for many, many years, I had no idea that AMPERS existed, knew nothing about it. You guys are kind enough to help fund us, so it's important that you do have an understanding of exactly what we are. First off, what we are not. So there's a lot of confusion about public broadcasting, and I'm going to get a little deeper in that in just a moment, but I will tell you that we are not affiliated with Minnesota Public Radio, Twin Cities Public Television, or Minnesota Public Television. We have a total of 18 stations. We'll be looking at the map here in just a moment, but we do go as far north as the Canadian border and as far south as the Iowa border and just about everything in between. Of those 18 stations, 17 of the 18 stations are eligible for state funding. KUMM in Morris is not eligible, and that's because it's based on statute. They do not have two full-time or full-time equivalent. Their budget is not large enough. It is truly a student-run station. So they are a member of AMPERS. We do help to support them, but they do not receive state funding. AMPERS primarily serves underserved communities. So what exactly is an underserved community? First off, communities of color. KMOJ is the only station in Minnesota whose mission is to serve communities of color, and the overwhelming majority of that audience is African American. We also have four stations that are Native American: KBFT in Boys Fort, KKWE in White Earth, WGZS in Fond du Lac, and KOJB in Leech Lake are all licensed either directly to the tribal government themselves, or in the case of KKWE, they are licensed to a nonprofit on the reservation that is a Native American nonprofit organization. We also serve new immigrant and, in some cases, students. And the reason that I say in some cases is that while a station may be housed and licensed to a college, school, or university, the majority of the programming is actually geared towards adults, the exception there of KUMM in Morris and also Radio K at the University of Minnesota. But you will find stations like KUMD who programs towards adults during the day, and then at night they may have programming that's geared more towards students.
Hay una alerta por vientos fríos en el área, lo que significa que podría ser extremadamente peligroso afuera.
So for those of you that don't speak Spanish, that was an announcement that we ran in the last polar vortex in 2014, alerting to the dangerous wind chills. We have programs in 12 different languages: Hmong, Somali, Oromo, Ojibwe, much more. Obviously, you just heard Spanish. I was very proud of that announcement, and here's why. We were very much ahead of the curve. Right now, there is a push from the FCC to get emergency messages translated into foreign languages and to try and do so in an automated fashion. We took the initiative long before that push, and really, I believe we were one of the first in the country to start getting amber alerts, severe weather alerts, out in foreign languages. I will tell you that I am not here to debate immigration reform, not my area, but we do feel that they are our constituents and they are our listeners, and we feel an obligation and responsibility to inform them. And if they just recently moved here and they don't speak English, they don't know that if they go outside tomorrow, that in a matter of 5 minutes, coming from Somalia, Kenya, that their body can literally freeze. So we do our very best, while the technology is starting to get better about doing emergency messages in foreign languages. In the meantime, we will actually do it the old-fashioned way, manually, and get those announcements out. The stations are programmed by and for their local community, and they are not allowed to run commercials, and that is because they are licensed as public. And that leads to a lot of the confusion about AMPERS and Minnesota Public Radio. Both stations, or both groups, I should say, are licensed as public, and neither of the two can air commercials. That's basically where the similarities end and the differences begin. So AMPERS is an association rather than a network. Sometimes people will refer to AMPERS as the AMPERS network, but we are, in fact, basically a trade association. We exist to support the 18 independent community radio stations throughout Minnesota. So when you're listening to, and I used to have to, when I would testify, say, if you could magically listen to WTIP in Grand Marais and KQAL in Winona, that you would not hear the exact same programming because they're programming for their specific community. You no longer have to have magic to do that. You can listen online. So if you were to listen online, you're going to hear a very different program at WTIP or KSRQ in Thief River Falls than you are in Winona. That's because we are an association. We're not taking one main program from the Twin Cities and sending it out statewide. We are allowing the stations to program what they want for their communities. I will tell you, in full disclosure, being completely transparent, when I go to some and listen to some of the stations, doesn't really appeal to me. I'm a big city guy. If you guys go fishing at all, you probably aren't going to put filet mignon on the end of your hook there. You may love it, but it's probably not going to get fish. They're not programming for me when I go to some of these smaller stations. I don't really want to hear about what's going on in the community basement on Sunday. But the people of those communities do, and they serve a very important purpose. I am not saying anything negative in any way, shape, or form about Minnesota Public Radio. I just want to make sure that everybody understands that there is a significant difference. In the case of Amperis, the stations are all licensed to either a college, school, or university, the tribal governments, or in some cases like KMOJ here in the Twin Cities, KFEI in Twin Cities, KAXE and KBXE in Grand Rapids, Bemidji, Brainerd area. They are licensed directly to the community rather than to an educational institution. Perhaps the largest difference between Amperis and Minnesota Public Radio, collectively, if we were to take all 18 of our stations' revenue, you're looking at maybe about $9 million, if that. And Minnesota Public Radio has about $100 million revenue. So a little bit different in that regard. We basically like to say, when you're first learning about Amperis, consider Amperis to be kind of your corner drugstore, corner hardware store. Minnesota Public Radio is going to be Target, Home Depot, serving the masses. I am not knocking them. I shopped at both this past weekend, bought myself a new snowblower just in time. Also went to S&S Hardware, so in St. Paul and Randolph and Fairview, I believe. But bottom line is we are community radio. They are public radio. We are licensed the same. We're serving very, very different audiences and have very different needs. We do have some newer stations. KRPR in Rochester joined us a handful of years, a little less, probably about 3 years ago, I believe. WGZS in Fond du Lac and KBXE in Bemidji are our most recent stations. Sometimes I will get new members of a committee, and they will come up and say, Joel, you know, we don't have a community radio station in our area. Can you help us to get one? Amperis does not buy, sell, develop radio stations. We exist to support the stations that are already there. We do start to get involved if a community has gotten a build permit and they've started the process, but honestly, it's going to be a monumental challenge because there really are not any frequencies open throughout the state of Minnesota. So it's unlikely that we will see many more. You are seeing a proliferation of low-power FMs, although that window has now closed as well. Amperis is not affiliated with the low-power FMs. The main difference between an Amperis station and a low-power FM, Amperis stations have a very large trade radius because they are a full-powered station. A low-power FM, you're going to have maybe a 2 to 5 mile at best radius. The Amperis board did decide not to include low-power FMs, and there are two reasons for that. One is a big part of what we do in our support is working with you here at the legislature, and low-power FMs are not eligible for state funding. But also, since I started in 2009, we've gone from 12 to 18 stations. We are really at max capacity as far as being able to support the stations. And when low-power FM window opened up, you saw a huge proliferation of the low-power FMs. And we simply just don't have the resources to be able to support them. Many of them are also religious in nature, and our stations are not religious. So I was also asked to explain how we serve our communities, because we do receive community service grants through this committee and through the general fund. One big way is emergency services and in-depth reports on weather and other emergency information. What I mean by that is when a commercial station has and there's something going on in their area, yes, you may hear the tones, you may hear an alert, whether you won't actually hear the tones because the emergency alert system where you hear those tones has actually, well, a fun fact that you can leave with, the emergency alert system has never been activated in its existence for an actual emergency. Almost was on 9/11. It has only been activated for a test. So, but we work on a very granular level, and what I mean by that is when emergencies go out, commercial stations are going to run that message, and they may talk about something for a minute and a half. Our stations are going to have the fire chief on when there's a forest fire, an emergency manager from whatever county, and they're going to be on for half hour, 45 minutes, an hour, telling the listeners exactly where they can go, where they can't go, what's going on, what roads are open, what roads are closed. You're not going to get that on commercial stations, and you're not really going to get that anyplace else. And in fact, in some of our communities, like Grand Marais, WTIP, they are literally providing the only local daily source of information. So they are providing really, really important information. in addition to providing some local entertainment as well. The stations also have a very strong commitment to education. I'm going to play for you a segment called Veterans Voices Vietnam. We have been doing the Veterans Voices series for about 5 years now. We do get state funding through the Veterans Affairs Division, through the General Fund. This is programming that AMPRS creates. And again, keep in mind they're all independent stations, so they don't have to run this. In the case of Veterans Voices, which we're about to hear, 17 of the 18 stations choose to run it. One of them feels that they are too music intensive to break format for this. And because we're an association, we allow them to make that decision.
This is Veterans Voices with Kevin Berger, memories and stories of Minnesota's Vietnam veterans.
My name is Lee Walker. I served in Vietnam. I was in the Army, and I served in infantry.
After 2 years of college, Lee Walker was drafted and sent to Vietnam.
Everything happened so fast, so quick.
10 months later, his squad of eight walked into an ambush.
Claymore mines, automatic rifles, and everything they had. Grenade launchers went off. I took a round through my back that came out through my chest. But I had access to the radio. I could talk on the radio. And I told the company commander we had been shot.
Walker was medevaced to a field hospital, then to Saigon, then recovered for a month in Japan before returning to the U.S. for weeks of rehab. He still feels those injuries.
It's internal. It's internal damage. There's shrapnel on my lungs and in my back and stuff like that.
The legacy of that traumatic day is more than physical.
It gets easier, but it's never over. But many of us have sleepless nights where we dream about that firefight that we were in. We dream about what happened and how we got out.
Walker does talk about the GI Bill, which allowed him to complete his education and prepared him for a successful career as an electrician.
I was able to go to school tuition free.
But you earned that.
I earned it, but I didn't know I had earned it.
Veterans Voices Vietnam is produced by AMPRS in partnership with the Minnesota Humanities Center and support from the state of Minnesota. Online at AMPRS.org.
So that's one example of educational programming that we do. That's one very small example, but I will say one thing that is really nice about that is we get to legally double dip. And here's what I mean by that. We produce it and put it out over the radio, but we are hearing from and catering to more and more teachers who are utilizing the content that we create like that in the classroom. I originally thought that might be a little bit too short for a teacher. We have a booth in the education building, just actually a couple booths down from your booth out at the state fair. And I can't tell you the number of teachers who have come out and said, hey, we love that. And we actually did a teacher focus group to find out what it is that they want, because we produce these shorter versions, but out of demand, we also create longer podcast 15-20 minute segments. And what we were told by the teachers is they love these short ones because they are perfect idea starters or conversation starters. They play them and that leads to the conversation. And these are all veterans from Minnesota who served. We did World War II, we did Vietnam. We have a bill going through right now for Korea. So they use those in the classroom, but then they like to use the longer ones occasionally in the classroom, but they will assign it as homework. And the students will be assigned to go home and either listen to it or use it as part of a presentation. So you're getting really a two-for-one here with taxpayer dollars. You're getting the radio programming. Actually, I guess three-for-one, because they get the radio programming, you get the classroom. But we also archive them online, so if people want to listen at a later time, they can always go back and listen on demand. Education also goes beyond textbook or history type of lessons. A lot of what we do is actually train broadcasters. So KFAI, for example, trains 60 non-traditional students each year. I think I mentioned we train between 1,200 and 1,500 students a year. Those are more in traditional. Those are going to be in high school, college, but we also do train non-traditional students. If somebody in the community just wants to learn to become a broadcaster, they can sign up, they learn how to run the audio board, There are actually 80 volunteers on KFAI alone that host the programs. So there is an opportunity to actually get hands-on training and not actually even have to pay for it. They can go and learn to do production, learn to be a host. And you get them as young as high school.
Hello, Jazz 88 listeners. I'm Gabe Ferguson, a sophomore at Minneapolis South High School. In the Open program, we just finished our final interdisciplinary projects that combine biology, English, and U.S. history. I chose a theme of music as a vehicle of expression and survival. In biology, I examined the effect of music on heart rate. In U.S. history, I analyzed the Harlem Renaissance and protest songs. In English, I wrote poetry about literary characters that used music to express themselves. Combining these classes through this theme enhanced my understanding. For Jazz 88, I'm Gabe from South High.
So that's one example of school news on Jazz 88 here in the Twin Cities, KPEM, which is located in Minneapolis North. But we go even younger than that.
Hi, this is Mimi.
And this is Honest.
From Whittier International School. And this is school news.
My favorite thing about Whittier is learning math. We are doing subtraction and regrouping.
My favorite thing about Whittier is having lots of time to play outside with friends. This is Arvis.
And this is Mimi. Reporting from Whittier International School. Go Wolves!
So there you have an example as how young we get. I included that both of those samples are from Jazz 88 and Marketing 101 when I took that in college. They told me to always include pets and kids whenever possible. But also, I figured that at 8 o'clock in the morning, with these being from Jazz 88, I did need to jazz things up a little. Sorry, couldn't resist. It's a morning show. Some of the stations will broadcast their actual high school sports games. Believe it or not, some will even broadcast the high school choir and band concerts. We get that local. Each station does have their own board of directors and advisory committees. Another good example of how local we get would be KVSC in St. Cloud, and they partner with the Central Minnesota Audio Newspaper Program. If we take a look here, if you look to the screen, those are all Central Minnesota newspapers. All of those newspapers participate in KVSC's Newspaper for the Blind program. It's not just the Star Tribune or the Pioneer Press. Volunteers come in and actually read these, and they go out to receivers. That's one of the public services that we provide. So how do we use the community service grants? Now, stations use it to pay electric bills. That's perhaps one of our largest expenses. Actually, not perhaps. It is our largest expense that we have to cover is our electric bill. Tower fees are also incredibly high. Salaries. It's also important to note that the state funds are used to secure matching dollars from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'd love to say that we have more flashy needs and that we're going out and buying the latest of whatever. Honestly, that's just not who we are, and that's not what we're doing. We are providing very, very important services for our community. And as a result, because you come across situations like this, switching to our community service grant, take a look at the screen there. You wonder what happens when a 100-mile-an-hour wind crosses the top of the IDS tower? This is what happens. That area circled is actually supposed to be connected. Obviously, it is not. If you take a closer look at it, that's because it's snapped in half. That is what happens when 100-mile-an-hour winds cross the IDS tower. What does that have to do with us and why I'm here today? Yes, of course, they have insurance, and insurance covered much of that, but they still had a $2,500 deductible. These stations do not have $2,500 sitting around for a situation like that, so KFAI had to make some changes to how they were planning to use their equipment grant so that they could replace the antenna and actually continue broadcasting. So we will repair transmitters. Sometimes they'll pool their money with additional funding to actually truly replace rather than repair. Audio boards are failing. They're replacing those. KRPR in Rochester bought a new emergency alert system so that their signal can actually put out an emergency alert in Spanish. Some of the other stations already had that, but in this last biennium, KRPR Rochester did that. And literally, if you ever have the opportunity to go to, and I would encourage you, and hopefully my stations are inviting you in, to not only see, but talk a little bit on the air about what's going on at the legislature. But if you go in, you will see, this is not state-of-the-art broadcasting. They are literally repairing frayed wires with first duct tape, and after that, then they will actually go in and replace the wire itself. As far as our request of this committee, so we are asking for an appropriation of $284,000 for an equipment grant. That is a slight increase of $50,000 over the last biennium. But more importantly, what I'd like to point out is that would actually get us flat till the 2016-2017, so not this last biennium, but the biennium before, because there was a significant decrease, which hit the stations especially hard because we grew in stations and the appropriation went down. So on a per station basis, it went down fairly substantially. So it's a modest increase over last year, but more importantly, flat from the biennium before. And for our community service grants, we are requesting $984,000. Again, that's an increase over the last biennium, but it would be flat to the biennium before that, and that is how we came to that number. We don't just randomly, we're not coming in and saying, well, please just increase us, we really would like that. We're simply trying to get back to where we were two bienniums ago. So with that, Mr. Chair, members, again, thank you for having me here today. Thank you for your continued support, and I am available should there be any questions.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testifier, there's a lot of radio stations around here. Do you have, I don't expect you to have it in front of you, but is there a place a person can go to find how many listeners per station and how many of those would be repeat listeners so that we know how many people are being truly served by this?
Mr. Glazer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, members, in some cases, yes. In most of our cases, no. And the reason for that is that there is now only one rating service. There used to be Nielsen and Arbitron. They have merged, and it is just the Nielsen ratings. And even when there were two, in most of these markets, they do not drop surveys in that area. It's what's referred to as a non-surveyed market. So we are able to, and we do report, there is a generally accepted national formula. For every one donor, there is typically 10 listeners. That's kind of the accepted norm to come up with the best estimate. So a couple of the stations, like Jazz 88, will have access to the ratings, and I can tell you that they're at about 140,000 people who listen per week. But because these stations are in smaller communities, it's just not in Nielsen's interest. They don't see it as worth actually taking the time to do that survey, so unfortunately they do not.
Representative Green.
Thank you. You know, I think that maybe even the stations might want to, you know, look into how many are there. The other question is on training. You said you help train 1,300 students every year. I'd like to know, are these students just high school kids, or are they actually coming in because you're supplementing some other form of education? And then I'll ask the second part of that, so then I'll be done. The other part is, when people do come in and take your training, is there any kind of certification they can take back with them as far as going to get a job or taking into school where they're going to learn broadcasting?
Mr. Glazer.
Chairman Nelson, Representative Green, members, very good questions. Going back in order to your first question, as far as is it supplementing or supplanting, even though we're not legacy, as far as supplementing the education, these are not, in most cases, and there may be an exception at KVSC and St. Cloud, but in most cases, these are considered extracurricular activities that they are allowed. They will go in, for example, at KUMD in Duluth. They have, I think they're up to 50 students in Duluth. Though they are not taking a broadcasting class, they are coming in kind of as a club and getting the opportunity to learn and be on the air as an extracurricular activity. Minneapolis North, it is not part of the regular curriculum. There, too, it's after school, so it is an extracurricular activity that they are benefiting from. So it's not, we're not funding it through a school. In the cases of the universities, there's very minimal funding that go to the stations themselves. They will cover the rent, oftentimes, not always, but they'll cover the rent of where they are because they're physically in that building, and they may pay a salary or two at most, but there's very, very, very limited funds coming from the university. The stations have to generate their own funds to operate. As far as the answer to the certification, in broadcasting, and I was just going over this with somebody who is looking to break into the industry, while there is not an actual certification, what you get is a demo reel, and that is what gets you hired. And I can tell you, as a hiring manager, and I used to be executive producer of a TV station, when you look, you can look at a resume, and you can look at certifications, and that really doesn't matter. What I'm looking at is your demo reel. And the students will leave this with a demo reel. And, in fact, I'm glad you asked because I skipped over this in my example. WTIP in Grand Marais told me just yesterday that one of their students from their youth radio project has since gone on to graduate from college and is now a full-time reporter for WTIP in Grand Marais. So they started a youth radio project, and actually we had another similar situation here just recently with KMOJ, where a student got trained as a volunteer, and then they got hired on as a full-time employee.
Well, thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just more of a comment that I actually stream KUMD every morning before I come, as another source of like how to stay in touch with my community. So just to the point that like it is very community driven, and I usually hear an interview from someone in my community about what's going on. There's different shows relevant, so it's just another touch point when I'm down here at the legislature of way to really get into the feel of what's going on in my community every week, and I just really appreciate that.
I didn't hear your question there, but yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was just a comment.
It's okay. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Glasser, I think it's great that you have these local radio stations. As a basketball official, it's great to hear that they catch my calls. What I'm wondering about, and actually Representative Olson just maybe went down that path, the future of where you're going. And I know that a lot of the radio equipment must be getting hard to get and antiquated. And are you focusing more on, as we get the state more broadband connectivity, are you focusing more on getting your programming towards the internet so we can cover the whole state with your programming? And it sounds like all these stations that you represent, do they put it live stream?
Mr. Glazer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, members, the answer is yes, all of them attempt to live stream. I believe 85% are streaming live, and if you go to ampers.org at the bottom, if you look at the sheet that I handed out that has our request on one side, on the back, it'll give you all the dial positions, and at the very bottom it says you can also listen online at ampers.org. So if you go to ampers.org, any of the streams that are working, you can listen right there. Most of the stations also will have it on their station website, but on the Ampers website, you can listen. I believe WGZS and Fond du Lac, because of their broadband issue, are still having a problem streaming off of the reservation, and one of the other ones is having a technical problem. But of the 18, I think right now 16 of the 18 are broadcasting streaming. So they not only stream live, but they also Ampers archives a lot of the joint programming, and the stations will archive. For copyright reasons, many of the archive programs are only up for 2 weeks, but if it is not copywritten material, then it can be up in perpetuity. But yes, we are putting more and more of an emphasis on the internet. But I will also say that we do not have concerns about going away, because there is going to always be a need for hyper local. The big corporate radio, if they're not taking the lessons and going local, I would be concerned if I was an employee there. But as far as the longevity of local community radio, there's always going to be that need.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I was in college, one of the exciting things I did was to volunteer on the radio stations, and that was really fun. My oldest son did that, and he eventually became a disc jockey. Not a disc jockey. Broadcaster, until he found out how challenging it is to make a living in the small stations. My younger son now, I don't think he has a radio in his house. And when my granddaughter's in my car, she wants to know why I'm listening to ads all the time. So it's, you know, it's just amazing the change. But to my question, a few years ago, we were trying to figure out how to reach the Somali community. And I didn't realize at that point that there was radio for Somalis, the Latino stations we know. So how do you get the information out to the populations that there are nationality type stations, and is there one for Russians?
Mr. Glazer.
Chairman Nelson, Representative Mason, members, we really primarily, because we are working with small budgets, primarily are getting the word out through word of mouth, because the hosts themselves are members of those communities. So they are then reaching out and letting people know that, hey, I've got a show. So KFAI actually has three shows that two are actually in Somali. One is in English, but catering towards Somali. So that really goes out through the hosts and the volunteers. And it's funny that you should ask on Russian, because I was just talking to somebody, I believe it was yesterday, explaining that we do not have any programming in Russian, despite having a very large Russian population. And I can only hypothesize, and I will give you a brief hypothesis and open up for if there are any last questions. The programs are based on supply and demand, and community members coming to the stations and saying, hey, we have a really large Somali population, and we have people who would like to host a Somali program. In all the time that I have been here, we have never had anybody come from the Russian community and say, we would like to have a program catered towards the Russian community. My hypothesis there is that in Russia, former Soviet Union, it is a government-controlled propaganda arm. And I think that there perhaps is some concern and trepidation about being involved in radio because of that. But that is just Joel Glazer's guess as to why we haven't seen it. But we have not had anyone actually approach in that community.
Representative Mason.
Thank you. Most of us do email updates from the House. So perhaps if you have some time, if you could just give us like a few sentences that we could include about this in our updates, that might be really helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, I will absolutely work with the committee administrator and get something out that is marketing that we can't buy. That would be fantastic. We would appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has already been answered, but I would also then add the comment that my son participated at Radio K when he was in college, and not only did it give him insight into radio production, but it also gave him a community to connect with. And that, when you're talking about students and their place to belong and a place to create community, I think is a very good thing. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Glazer, I'm going to follow up and tag team on Representative Hewitt's question to you about live streaming. And I understand that you're dealing with two different wattages, both full power and low power. So if you could give me the threshold for what a low power radio station versus a full power radio station is, that just for clarification. But I'm wondering if to the representative's question, with the advent of everyone, literally, as you look around the committee table, most of us either are currently or have, during the course of this committee, looked at our smartphones. And in the advent of what we do and with bills before us now for the prohibition of texting while we are driving, but most of us have a smartphone with any number of apps on them, why wouldn't Ampers want to embrace, and I'm not saying it in a derogatory sense, but with the availability and the dissemination of information through live streaming and what have you, is that an avenue that Ampers and its affiliates should embrace even more, particularly with the limited budgets you have and with also the proliferation of app designers and whatnot? It seems like to Representative Masons have a ready audience looking for information that is very personalized to what they're looking for.
Mr. Glazer.
Chairman Nelson, Representative Albright, members, to answer that question, we did create an app about 6 years ago, and it was not accessed that much, but that was also 6 years ago. What we have found is that there are multiple apps out there where we are available, TuneIn, for example, and people are accessing the streams in that method. So to be financially prudent, we are opting to utilize the other opportunities that are out there for free that are generating and driving people there. Another area that we're really seeing a large growth is in home. Radio is really consumed primarily in the car, as was being pointed out. I will also mention, I didn't know we would be talking about this today, but I can follow up with specifics, but radio is at an all-time high. It's actually, as far as source of audio information, 47% of adults get their audio, the most you get their audio from radio. The next closest after that, third one was YouTube, and I'm drawing a blank on the second one, but it drops down into the teens. So you're talking about 47% versus the teens. So we are embracing it, but the reason that we're seeing an increase in in-home listening is because of smart speakers. Alexa, play Jazz 88, and Alexa will start playing Jazz 88. Alexa, play Radio K. I can tell you that despite working in the industry, I didn't used to listen to radio in the home, and now that I have a smart speaker and I'm cooking, oftentimes I will say, Alexa, play, insert here. So yes, we are embracing it. The app, with so few people going, and the problem with an app is you have to keep investing more and more, believe it or not, and it gets fairly pricey to keep that going. So some of the stations do have their own individual apps, but as far as Amper's investing in it, it became too costly to keep all 18. But we are definitely embracing it and utilizing the free services out there.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you could just remind for the committee the difference between full power and low power.
Thank you.
Representative Mr. Glazer.
Chair Nelson, Representative Albright, members, thank you. I apologize. I did not mention that. So our largest stations get as large as 100,000 watt. KUMD in Duluth is a 100,000 watt station. Some of the full power stations may get as low as 1,000 watt. It has to do with the wattage, but also the height because it's line of sight. So if you're atop of the IDS, you don't need to have as much wattage because nothing's going to be getting in your way. A low power FM, I think it's like 5 or 10 watts, but I'd have to look. But you're talking about, as far as mileage goes, or distance, a low power, it's usually about 2 miles. If there's nothing in the way, it can get as much as 10 miles, but it's usually 2 to 5 miles from where they're broadcasting from. And a full power station is going to be about 60 to 70 miles outside of where they're broadcasting from. So Twin Cities, you get about halfway down to the Rochester area, and that's when you're going to switch. If you're listening to this, in fact, two of our Amper stations are on the same frequency. So as you leave KMOJ and pick up KRPR, it's about halfway park down to Rochester. So I don't know the exact wattage. I apologize, but it is a dramatic difference.
Maybe just a clarification. What is the average wattage then that for your stations? Is it 200 watts or 100 watts?
Mr. Chair Nelson, Representative Albright, I would have to look it up, but if you'd like me to know, I can follow up and email you. But my guess is, I think our smallest ones are 1,000, and many of them are much larger than that. So they range from 1,000 to 100,000 watts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. And thanks for your presentation. And with that, we'll move to our next presentation. And we have over from the Amherst Sports Commission, Todd Johnson, the Executive Director.
Chairman, members, my name is Todd Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. And with me is my Associate Director of the National Sports Center, Neil Ladd.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me. I'll try to catch up real quick. most of you look around the room. I know there's new faces, but most of you are familiar with the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission and specifically the flagship facility that is owned by the state but managed by the nonprofit, the National Sports Center up in Blaine, Minnesota, called the National Sports Center. We're a very tiny, small state agency. Our budget, is as you'll see when you get your actual budget overviews, is quite small, but it's fine by us. We figure out a way to make it work. It's about $300,000 a year, give or take, and to the extent you need to walk through some of that. Is that better? Thanks, Jim. Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Sorry about that. We can certainly walk through some of that, but I thought most interesting might be to walk through a publication that is coming around right now that walks through a little bit about what we do. What we really do is manage the National Sports Center, but we also administer grants throughout the entire state of Minnesota. Some of you may be familiar with the Mighty Ducks grants or the Hennepin County Ballpark grant program. We administer those programs and make sure that the money gets out the door with very, very little administrative cost, with the proper evaluation that is done as well. I'm just going to wait a little bit till you get these. So in 1987, Governor Perpich had a sort of bold idea that Minnesota should have an Olympic training facility. He had come back from Europe and decided to give it a go. And at the time, people thought it was pretty crazy to build a facility up on a sod farm up in Blaine, Minnesota. But as most of you have either been there or are familiar with the facility, know that it's been nothing but a major league success. I'm very conservative. I always have wanted to be very conservative of any estimates we have when we talk about economic impact of an event, because I don't really want to get caught in the concern of them being overinflated or that sort of thing. So the numbers that you see from the National Sports Center itself and from the USA Cup are just out-of-town visitors. That's not local repeat visitors. We're the second largest tourist attraction in the state, well behind, but behind the Mall of America. But after that, it's the National Sports Center, 4.2 million visitors. About 2.1 million go to the ice rinks, and the rest are for our sports. Roughly a 700-acre complex up there, everything from golf to Guinness Book of World Records, the world's largest soccer facility. Neil, do you want to walk just a little bit through the numbers?
Yeah, if you take a look at the sheet here, Todd mentioned it just a little bit, statewide impact through the Mighty Ducks grant program. If you look at what we like to really hang our hat on.
Sir, can you identify your name?
Oh, sorry, Neil Ladd, the Associate Executive Director for the National Sports Center. If you look at the map of Minnesota there, the grant dispersal throughout the entire state really is something that we hang our hat on. We start to look at kind of the economic impact for the state, and with almost $120 million coming from all of those facilities all over, you start to get the feel that the Amateur Sports Commission, with its $300,000 budget, can do quite a bit when given the authority to do that. So I don't know if you want me to talk each individual facility.
No, just that overview. Yeah. Representative Nash, I know you're quite familiar with the soccer facility and what we do up there. If you look at this side of the facility, we just want to walk through that particular event, which was started in 1985, actually, with 65 teams. We're now up to nearly 1,200 teams from 20 countries and 20 states. We just made news the other day because we'd been trying very hard. Rhode Island was the last state that was yet to participate, and we got a team coming in this year from Rhode Island. So our recruiting team was pretty excited about that opportunity. But if you look at what happens during those 10 days, it's pretty remarkable. If you think about 250 soccer games being played per day, you know, in order to do that, we have referees coming from all over the world. Our dormitories are full.
And just those 10 days, it's, you know, 9,000, almost 10,000 hotel room nights. So we're excited about the facility, but as we, it's not necessarily for the operating budget in this committee, but the facility's 30 years old and is starting to age, so we're going to spend a little bit more time in the capital bonding committee asking about some requests there. But for the most part, we're pretty excited about the facility and our future growth. If anyone's got any questions about the direction that we're headed, I'd be happy to share that with you.
Well, it's a thank you, and it's interesting that you mentioned Representative Nash because he has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Not really a question, but a comment. Yes, my son played many, many, many games on your various pitches and ultimately was a four-year NCAA soccer player. And I think that the exposure that he got playing in the various tournaments on your facility, well, I know it because he was recruited in part out of there. So was exposed to teams from around the world. It made my heart proud when we roundly defeated the Norwegians, even though that's my heritage. But we played teams from Norway, Sweden, Mexico, a lot of other places in championship games, and it's a great facility. And if you have a doubt as to the economic impact, try getting a seat at a restaurant or even getting into something as pedestrian as the Target. It's very busy. So for 10 days, it is bananas, and I know that there's a lot of different utilizations for the fields up there, so it's a good facility.
Well, thank you. And as a Swede, I was like hearing somebody defeating the Norwegians.
Well, it was a temporary thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I appreciate those comments.
Mr. Johnson.
And the thing is, that's sort of how that facility works up there. We're trying to do a little bit more to understand, to help people understand just the breadth of what we do. My boys were not soccer players. They were hockey players, and we would go up there for hockey. I barely knew before I was put on the board the level and extent of soccer. Hockey, one clear example, last weekend, and there's only 3 weekends of the year that were not open up there and completely full, and that's by choice because we actually rent out our parking lot for another event. But we're going all the time. Last weekend there was an event. A gentleman out of Canada actually rents the whole facility, and there were 85 teams for the weekend, and only 6 of those teams were from Minnesota. So, you know, depending upon what the sport is, there's always some crazy level of activity going on up there that is pretty clean and pretty worthwhile, I believe, economic development.
And Mr. Johnson, Minnesota. I've got it wrong, but isn't that where the velodrome is too? Is that where is that? I thought that needed some repairs or replacement. I had a friend that worked on it when it was originally built.
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, the velodrome is scheduled. This is scheduled to be its last year. As a trades carpenter, you would understand. So this facility was built, supposed to last 20 years. It's going on 30 years now. It's made of a wood called Afzelia wood from Africa. It's one of the hardest woods in the world. And unfortunately, it was never covered, so it sort of outlived its life. We're actually trying to figure out, and we're talking to the carpenters about what a proper way to reuse the wood and to repurpose the wood as it comes down. It's going to be, that particular parcel is going to be purchased by the Spring Lake Park School District as part of the development they have on our campus now. They built an elementary school on our campus, which is wonderful. You look at today, I was just showing one of my colleagues, actually board member Joel Carlson, who's on the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission board, that today, since school is closed, we've decided to open up our facility for anyone who can actually get there and play court sports, or we're going to open up 2 sheets of ice and then our 60,000 square foot indoor soccer facility for people to use. So I look at it as a state facility, as an asset for the public. It's one of the reasons I sought out. My father was a public school superintendent. He sought out very early in my career up there as executive director to find a way to get the schools involved, and that's what we've done.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, on page 3 of your agency expenditure overview, I just want to draw your attention and ask a question about it is a fairly brief, a very succinct overview, but I was attracted to the restricted miscellaneous special revenue account, and I'm wondering if you could elaborate on what that means.
Mr. Johnson, or Mr.
Ladd. I can as well, but go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that restricted special revenue was the ANOCA, or the Hennepin County Grant Fund program that the Amateur Sports Commission administers. Excuse me. Those are funds that come in, an evaluation is done of the grant program, and then those funds are then dispersed.
Mr. Ladd, is that the money that's tied to the Twin Stadium, the surplus, the money if it's coming from that?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Representative Waldron.
Just to confirm, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, any further questions? If not, members, we're going to be up in room 10 tomorrow. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Mason, I didn't see your hand.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. This sounds like, in Minnesota we have 10, how many arenas we have. We have arena for virtually every sport. So basically this is like a training for the national type of activities. What is your actual mission? Is my question.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, basically, as you look at the map and the distribution, what that really entails is the various grant programs that we've helped administer around the state of Minnesota. One specifically was something called the Mighty Ducks Grants. When more girls started playing hockey 20 to 25 years ago, the public policy was made that we needed to develop more ice arenas so there would be more ice time available, and that's one of the uses for that money. Subsequent to that have been clean indoor air issues with the propane Zambonis, to have them replaced with electric Zambonis, and so we've administered that grant program to make sure that there's a local match, and then we get the money out the door. That's basically what most of those facilities are. There are other bigger facilities like St. Cloud or Marshall or Miwabik where we have been the fiscal agent for the bonding that has gone on there, so they're included as well, but we don't have any part in running those facilities out. We just administer or are the fiscal agent for that bonding.
Thank you.
Anyway, as I was saying, members, tomorrow we're going to be in room 10, so we'll be on TV, so wear your best suits. anyway, and with that, if there's anything else, nothing else needs to come before the committee, we're adjourned.